Hey, you're listening to The Growth Signal. My name is Alyssa Nolte.
And I'm Sean Shannon.
And we are going to have a killer conversation today. So, Sean, let's get right into it. What is your hot take?
My hot take is Peter Drucker was right. The vast majority of businesses have no idea what their customers are buying.
Oh, God, I wish we could just like play that on a loop. The vast majority of businesses have no idea what their customers are buying.
Nope.
And I have a feeling I know where you're going to go with this, but I'm going to let you tell us a little bit more. Tell us more what you mean by that.
Well, they know what they're selling them. They know the product or the service that they're selling them, and they talk all about that product and service in terms of how to sell it. But they don't know what's motivating the purchase. They don't know what it is that's causing that client to want to purchase from them. And Clayton Christensen, one of my favorite Harvard business professors, came up with this idea of jobs theory, which is that we don't necessarily buy products and services as much as we hire them to do really specific jobs in our lives. And if we can untangle what the customer is hiring that product or service to do, we're in a really powerful place to figure out how to market, how to innovate, how to structure operations.
It is like, I'm a big believer in the universe kind of puts conversations in my path for a reason, because I was just having a very similar conversation with someone yesterday that, you know, our customers have more agency than ever before. And what I mean by that is that they have so much more choice. And it's no longer like, oh, you never get fired for hiring McKinsey. You never get fired for purchasing, you know, whatever product, whatever, like Cisco or whoever. And that really has changed. Like, they have so much more choice. They have so much more agency in the decision. And so before they said, well, I guess I got to buy this because I don't know what else to do. Now they actually have a decision-making process, and we as sellers have to tap into it.
So, absolutely right. They have access to more tools to do research. Speaking of McKinsey, they've done a longitudinal set of research about customer purchase path. And, you know, the historical thinking is that the sales funnel sort of flows down in this V shape, where customer becomes aware of a problem, they become interested in a solution, and then they build a consideration set of two or three options, try one or two, and then buy it. And what McKinsey has found is that with the advent of all of the research tools available to us, yeah, they become interested in a product or service, and they do start with two or three companies in their consideration set, but it then balloons out into almost a reverse hourglass shape, where they've now got 8, 9, 10 different companies that they're considering, right? And so it's, yes, the customer has so much more agency in terms of figuring out where they're going to go and find their solution. I'll give you the exclamation point to that study, which is that the companies that start out as being one of the two or three in the consideration set have a 2 to 3x better chance of closing the sale, which really sort of sells the idea of working upper funnel functions in terms of your marketing so that you make sure that you've got brand awareness, you're top of mind, right?
Yeah.
But the other piece of it from my perspective is not only the front end research, they've got granular tools to measure attribution as to whether or not this thing was working for them.
Yeah.
And so it's a heck of a lot easier them to find justification to fire us if we're not driving what they were expecting in terms of solutions.
It's so funny that you say all of those things, because I love brand research. It's like one of my favorite hobbies, yeah. I guess if you can call it a hobby. And I always tell people, like, you know, if you're going to the store and the importance of like top of mind brand recognition, and I'll say, okay, Sean, laundry detergent, who comes to mind?
Tide.
But first, you're going to say Tide, right?
Yes.
And Tide is going to win. They hold the market share. There's a reason that everybody says Tide. But then what happens is that my kid has an allergy to Tide. He breaks out if I wash his clothes in Tide. So all of a sudden, my shortlist had to fan out.
Yes.
And I started doing a ton of research on laundry detergent to figure out what was the best fit for me and my family. So I found we started using Gain. And then I started using powdered Gain. But then I discovered the powdered Gain didn't wash my clothes as well because I have a high efficiency washer. So now I'm on a new journey to try something new. And that's a consumer-based product. And
yeah,
that makes sense in the consumer level. I think that that is happening in the business-to-business world, which used to be insulated from having to create loyalty And having to solve problems consistently and continually. I think that there's a real reckoning coming for our business to business products and services because of this choice. And the same way that I'm willing to switch laundry detergent at the drop of a hat, people are starting to willing to be switching their MarTech or their conferencing software or whatever they're using because it's easier than ever before.
Yes. And, you know, it is an explosion of options in terms of where we get information. I mean, the thousands of people that listen to your podcast are being exposed to, you know, dozens and dozens of different opinions on where they should go and think. And I think about LinkedIn in particular as being, you know, listen, here's a place where a solopreneur or a small company can build a brand for itself with people that are trying to purchase in that small or medium-sized business solution marketplace.
Yeah. I love that you talk about brand too, because I think we have to all come to terms with the fact that we have been treating brand as a set of colors and a logo and not necessarily the way people feel about us. Yes. The number of people who have reached out to me because they said, oh, I listened to the podcast. You know, I heard that you do X, Y, and Z. Will you come pitch me for whatever service or solution simply because they listen to the podcast and they know me as a person? So therefore, they're willing to give me a shot because they've listened to the podcast. Didn't know anything about my services. I'm not a household name. I'm not, you know, a Fortune 100. But the way I made them feel in the conversation, a single solopreneur can really make a difference there.
Yeah, it really can. And you know, their brand is a really uniquely American idea. I mean, I teach marketing at the University of North Georgia. And I, you know, do an entire class on brand. And this idea that, you know, it started out as a way to mark cattle, to identify them as belonging to the owner, right? They branded them. But as the methods by which, and I love to talk about the fact that brand has changed at every single step of the way because of technology. Mm-hmm. That you know, listen, brand came necessary because there were stockyards that were made possible by railroads coming into place. Brand changed when we got to an age of mass media where we had newspapers, we had radio, we had television. Brand is changing again as we move from a B to C to a P to P. Where now suddenly I'm a brand manager. I'm no longer in control of my brand message because it is being spoken peer to peer by person to person. They're talking about me on social. They're talking about me. They're giving Yelp reviews. They're reading my podcast. I mean, there are, and so we've all got to be aware of what is our brand? What does it mean? And what are the emotions that people have when they do business with us?
I'm seeing a huge push for traditional companies, right? Not like small entrepreneur boutiques, not where it's a founder-led thing, but like everyday employees of you know, these major companies are being asked to build personal brands in support of the company's overall goals. Are you seeing that? And what is kind of your reaction to that?
So I've got two reactions to it. Yes, I'm seeing it. And yes, it's incredibly important that you have an understanding of yourself as an individual and what are the perceptions that people have about you, right? So whether you're going for the next job or you're launching your own business, what is it that people know you for? What are you world famous for? My fear on it is, and it gets a little spiritual, is that as we begin to think about ourselves as brands, we begin to objectify each other.
I kind of feel the same way. Like there's some things where, like I have multiple podcasts, I've done hundreds of episodes now, and I have to wonder, you know, is what you're seeing on the podcast 100% the same person you would see in person, right?
Yes.
And I try really hard to make that an intentional, like almost a one-to-one crossover, that the person you see on the podcast and the person you see in public is the same person. So that, because there's almost like a cognitive dissonance when you meet someone on LinkedIn who exudes a certain brand a certain way, and then you meet them in person and they're an entirely different person. That is very disconcerting, whether you can put your finger on it or not. And if brands, like companies do the same thing where there's someone online, but then you meet an employee who you're like, you work for this company?
Yeah.
That's who you work for, right?
Yeah. Oh, so yeah. And I want just 100% agree with you on that. And the problem is that you can get wrapped up into this persona that you're creating that, you know, whether it's on LinkedIn, doing LinkedIn lives, whether it's on YouTube, wherever you're doing your branding for yourself, if you get wrapped up in the persona, then you lose the person.
Yeah.
And what's going to end up, you know, what ends up happening is that businesses do business with people. And that's that disconnect that you're talking about. That if I am presenting myself in a way that it's different online than it is one-to-one, I'm sabotaging myself.
I want to kind of connect this back to your hot take, because you said that businesses don't really know what they're selling, right?
Yeah.
And that they might know physically the product and the features and the function, but they don't necessarily have a good connect on what they're selling. How much of that sale do you think is the experience that we have with our brand, regardless of the problem that we're solving, regardless of the job to be done? How much of what we need to sell is the way they feel about what they're getting from us?
I think it is the lens through which they see the results. If the results aren't there, I don't care what lens you put on it, they're not going to be happy. But, you know, at the end of the day, if we're going to create repeat business, then we need to have people both like, actually all three, like, trust, and respect us.
Yeah.
Right. And so, yeah, that emotion is the lens through which they're going to see it. If the results are there, they feel icky about working with us, they're not going to come back. But if they feel great about working with us, but the results aren't there, guess what? They're not going to come back. So it's a both and.
Yeah. And it's hard too, right?
Yes.
I got one of my, it's hard to call it a career start, but once upon a time, when I was getting started with my career, we were doing branding exercises for politicians.
Oh boy.
A brand was really cool, like a cool thing. We're talking like 15 years ago. Before personal brand and cult of personality was the way people thought about politicians. It was, you know, policy and the things that they were going to do and the party that they were aligned for, and not who they necessarily were individually. And so we were doing we took the way that we evaluate and do a brand equity study for businesses. You know, do we trust them? Do we like them? Do we believe that they're knowledgeable about us and our issues? Do they have the skills that it takes in order to solve our problem, right? Those things that have been measured for companies for decades and transferred it over to politicians, and found that the way people felt about the brand of the politician was more important than the things they actually like stood for and their platforms. And the way that they presented themselves as a brand was more likely to be indicative of how people were going to vote versus the things that they actually stood for on their platform. And that was a light bulb moment for me of like, oh, we are emotional creatures, not rational creatures.
And haven't we seen that play out the last 10 years in every election?
Yes. And it's funny because we were kind of on the tip of that. And then all of a sudden we started to see it really start to happen and really start to change. As we got out of politics after a couple of years, because it did start to get a little icky for us. And we were like, man, we don't need to be a part of this anymore. We'll go back to good old fashioned technology companies. But it was one of those things, though, where the skills that you learn about how to present yourself and tell your story in politics, in business, in personal relationships, in your personal life, those are transferable skills across the board. And it doesn't matter what you're selling, whether it's yourself or a future spouse on a date, whether it's a physical product or service, or whether it's to vote for you for an election, it is a selling motion.
It really is. And it's really about making the customer the hero of the story, as opposed to the product, the service, or the person that's selling it.
So when we're hearing, if someone is hearing this and they say, oh my gosh, we are selling something and we know the features, we know the form, we know the function, but we don't know what problem we're solving, or we can't articulate the job that our product does, how do they start to uncover that? How do they make it so that they have that competitive advantage in their pocket?
That's a great question. I tend to think about it this way: is what's the trigger event that leads somebody to say, I need to hire blank? So I was working with a fractional HR person, and you know what she was selling was HR services. I'm going to come in, I'm going to help you with your employee handbook. I come in, I'm going to help you maybe with your payroll. I'm going to help you with your employee benefits. But that's not what the customer is buying, you know? So she's talking to small and medium-sized business owners who do not have an HR specialist. And what ultimately leads them to say, I need to talk to somebody with more expertise than my office manager, is there's a dumpster fire.
Right.
A dumpster fire around compliance, or there's a dumpster fire around a potential harassment lawsuit. There's a dumpster fire around employee attrition. And if she can begin to language her marketing and her approach around, hey, are you finding yourself in a place where you're 6 months behind on your compliance paperwork? Are you finding yourself in a place where you are losing more employees than you thought you should? This is what I do to help. So enter it from, I sold media for 30 years, led sales teams in media. And what I would tell my salespeople is that most business owners only look at the world from behind their own counter, looking out at the world. They never have an opportunity to see their business from the outside in. And our job as sellers in the marketing space is to help them see their company from the outside in.
My brain is literally spinning. I can't keep it in anymore. I love this because it's so important that people can answer those questions, right? It reminds me of those like late night infomercials, like, are you finding yourself unable to, you know, have you fallen and you can't get up? Yes. Oh my God, I have. Then you need Life Alert, right? How do we phrase that in a way that our customers can say, oh my gosh, yes, you're right. I am, insert whatever we're doing. And too often we lead with like, well, you know, this feature can change your life.
Yes. Right. And again, it goes back to making the customer the hero of the story. Let me start with their story. What's going on in their business from a B2B standpoint? What's happening that's not working? What's keeping them up at night? Let me begin to language toward that as opposed to what my solution is.
So if you and I are in wild agreement that this is the way it should be done, why is it not happening?
Well, I think it goes back to that myopic view. We end up buying our own story. We end up, right? What's that? The old phrase, you're reading your own press clippings. We spend so much of our time inside our own business, working on our solutions, working on our product, that we lose track of what that product is going to mean in terms of an outcome for the customer.
So how do we step outside of our own press clippings or out of our own story? And rather than thinking first person, how do we step out and become that third person point of view?
So I think there are a number of things that we can do. You know, first is if you've got a sales force, ask your sales team, what are people talking about when it comes to when they purchase our product? How do they feel about it? What are you seeing? You can find a lot of great feedback on social media. So are you spending enough time out on your company's social media seeing how customers are reacting with your product or your service? Are you mystery shopping yourself? Do you have trusted people that can come in and use your product or service and give you feedback on it, right? But they're all very intentional moves to the outside.
It is hard to, right? Because especially if you're a small business and you are maybe a founder of your business, like I've grown businesses and I usually love my solution because it's my thing. And I spend all of my time thinking about it and talking about it. And I have all of the context that has ever existed about the why behind my what.
Yes.
And so it is really hard to kind of separate your product, your service, the thing that you are selling from you as a person. And I found sometimes I have to have someone who is completely outside of my circle. They can't be a friend or a family member or someone who loves and respects me. It has to be someone who has an objective opinion of what's going on, so I can tell that story in a way that resonates beyond the people who will give me the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, you need people that have the courage of their convictions and can give you the honesty that you're not getting. There's a great story about Dos Equis, which is now, if I'm not mistaken, either the number one or two selling beer brand in the United States. And they launched a campaign about 15 years ago, the most interesting man in the world.
Yep.
And the tagline on it was, "I don't always drink beer, but when I do, I drink Dos Equis." Part of that campaign's inspiration came from the feedback their salespeople were giving them. So, you know, in the beer business, the mantra is that people build brand preference on premise in restaurants and bars, and then they leverage that brand preference when they go out and purchase at retail. In other words, if I'm going to try a beer that's new to me, I'm probably going to try it when I'm in a bar or a restaurant.
Yep.
Even though only 25 or 30% of sales come from it, it's really important that these beer brands have their salespeople, their field reps out observing, seeing what's going on in the field. So at the moment that they were struggling with this issue of how do we grow our brand, there was a move toward cocktail culture. And so their target of 18 to 30 year olds were more than likely going to purchase a cocktail as opposed to a beer. But what these guys observed was that around 11 o'clock at night, there was this switch. People, men in particular, to buy beer instead of cocktails. It was cheaper, it was lower in alcohol, and it gave them a longer runway in the bar to accomplish what they were there to accomplish. And so there came the idea of, I don't always drink beer when I do, but when I do drink beer, I drink Dos Equis. They made their consumer the hero and observed their behavior in the marketplace.
I do want to come back to your comment, though, about how in the restaurant business, they want that almost like a gateway. And it occurs to me that it is just as much about creating a low barrier to try something. Because if you send me to the grocery store, I'm going to have to buy a case. So I'm stuck with between 12 and 24 of these beers. And what if I don't like them? Right.
Yes.
Whereas in a restaurant, one glass, what's the harm? My bartender might even give me a little taster. Right. So how do we create low barrier options for our customers to just take a chance on us?
So, there's this idea of the mafia offer. Right. I'm going to give you an offer you can't refuse. So do we have a free trial? Do we have a money back guarantee? Do we have a downloadable piece of a guidebook, right? What are those offers they can't refuse that get them to engage with us and have an experience of what it is that we're doing where they don't have to put an enormous amount at risk?
I love that because I think a lot of owners are scared that if they give away too much for free, then people will never want to pay for it. And I think it's kind of the opposite. You give away, give value right away. I have a note-taking app that I use, and it's a competitor to OneNote, and it has been free for the last 6 months while it was in beta testing.
Yes.
And then they just sent me an email and they're like, "Hey, we're out of testing now. We're going to go to $15 a month. Are you still down to be a user?" And I immediately said yes, because I've gotten so much value out of it for the last 6 months. I couldn't imagine transitioning away from it.
Well, and think about, what they've done by making that free offer is they have provided value to you, which is, listen, it's always better to give than to receive.
I mean, always
heard that from when we were kids. But the other thing they did was that they enmeshed themselves in your daily lifestyle and they created enormous switching costs for you.
Yeah. So, I'd rather pay $15 than spend time trying to find a new solution or to use a subpar solution that I don't like.
That's exactly it, right? And so, the question is, how much is enough to attract somebody in? How much is too much? Because we don't want to spill the candy in the lobby. If I'm selling candy in an office, I don't want to get it all out in the lobby.
So, thinking about all of the incredible people that you know or aspire to know, who else should we be listening to?
So he passed away a few years ago, but Clayton Christensen, who I mentioned earlier, listen, if you want a good lesson in understanding your customer, type into Google Clayton Christian milkshake video. And it is about 8 minutes. It is a lecture he did at the University of Phoenix about a research project that they did for McDonald's around milkshakes. And it will clarify better than anything I've ever seen how to understand what your target is coming to buy from you.
And if someone is hearing this and they want to hear more from you, they want to follow along, they want to connect, where can they find you online?
Jump on strategicgrowthdesign.com, or you can find me on LinkedIn, Sean Shannon. Just look for, to type in Sean Shannon, sales acceleration.
This was an incredible conversation, Sean. Thank you so much for coming on the Growth Signal.
I appreciate you having me on, Alyssa.